I'm going to begin with a word about new exercise. So I haven't printed handouts for you, but there's two already up there on the main course web page. One is a revised list of the people in the class and their groups, but it now includes a column on which wiki you personally have been allocated to critique. Up there too is a handout describing the exercise, which I'll describe it briefly now, but a more considered instructions are there. And on the Moodle page, there's two things relevant to this exercise. One is you can download a Word document that's the fulfilling your critique into, although feel absolutely free to change the headings and so on, but that will be a starting point. And there's a new forum. I said wiki, that's wrong. So in this new forum, I've created a thread, one for each group, and the idea is when you've done your critique, you post your critique to the thread to do with the forum that you've commented on. So that's the outline of it. The idea is both to help other people in the class by commenting on how helpful you think their wiki is in time for them to be able to edit it. You'll probably also find that that gets you thinking again about the structure of your own wiki, so there should be some positive backwash onto your own group's work. I see the vast majority of you have already got a large draft up on time. Four groups haven't done it yet. those who haven't done it need to get it up in time if they're ever going to receive a worthwhile critique from other people. There's more remarks on that on the handout sheet. Any instant questions about that? Feel equipped to go away and have a look. Actually, I should be doing some pointing, shouldn't I? Wakey wakey. So this is the Moodle page, and I've put the stuff for the critiquing underneath the list of shortcuts into wikis. So this is the critique pro forma, and this is the forum, and as you can see, I've created a topic for each of those. Let's pick one at random. And inside there, you'll see an introductory message for me. And the idea with your critiques is you post a message in there, following up that one. Now, what was the other thing I was going to point out? If I can't remember, it can't be important, can it? Right. So there's also a private forum there. I quite appreciate that perhaps most of your groups may have found other ways of talking to each other than this forum. However, one of the things about Moodle is it keeps a complete record. So there are a couple of things I'd like each group to make sure they do before the end of the course. so that they're on the record. One is, at the beginning of this course, you were asked to critique some wiki or wikis from past years and to draw conclusions about your views about the wiki format. And I'd like you to make sure you've posted in that private group forum what your group thought about, came to a conclusion on, so I know you've done it. If you've got it somewhere else, like on a Facebook group, just copy and paste it into a new message. The other thing is that in marking the coursework, in marking the wikis, obviously the first thing I take into account is how many people are in the group, because that varies from 2 to 4 in this class, and all of those numbers are smaller than I've had in groups in past years, so I'm not expecting it every wiki to have the same amount of total work in, just in proportion to the number of participants. Now, if I don't hear any different, I'll assume people have contributed equally. And that's usually true, but it's not always true of every group. So I want you to post a statement or statements about the division of labour within your group. There are two ways of doing that. If you're a hyper-integrated set of buddies, you can send in a joint statement and all sign it, and that's absolutely fine. If you're less completely integrated, or even if you're at war, then each of you post a bit saying what you have done as a contribution. And I don't advise lying, because every edit action you do on Moodle is recorded, so if people are contradicting each other, I'll go and look and see who's done what. Right. And I'll mention this again at the end, but I'm planning to spend a lot of our fifth and final session on a kind of exam practice, in which I'll put up a possible exam question, ask you all to jot down an essay plan, how you might answer that, and then we'll discuss people's essay plans. And certainly that's sometimes been extremely useful to students in the past. It won't work well unless you've got enough, not necessarily of detailed knowledge which you've memorised, but you've got enough in your head to have some overview of the course and to be able to answer any of the questions in some way or another. So from that point of view, it would be good if you managed to read all the wikis for this year and to some extent from past years. And then you ought to be able to sketch out, or practice sketching out, answers to typical exam questions. Now, part of the reason for practice is always good, but partly is because it will give you a sense of what you wished you knew when the question popped up, and what kind of selective selection of topics would help you to answer a range of questions. And the other thing is, assuming a decent proportion of the class have done it and we get to hear their essay plans, the other thing is different people always answer it very differently from each other, and therefore by hearing the kind of essay plan other people produce, it gives you a sense of just how differently equally good answers can be. And that's hard for me to provide, because I'm stuck inside my own monocular view just as much as you are, and it's obviously hard for students, because what's true of all of us is if we're working at the limit of capacity, and I hope in the exam you will be, we just barely produce an answer, and we can't imagine there's any other possible way it could have been done until you come across someone else's answer and realise that without necessarily being better or worse, it was just very different and you didn't think of it from that angle, and in future you might like to consciously consider alternatives rather than being stuck with the particular things that pop into your head. So, I won't be checking up on whether you've done this last piece of homework, but you will get much more out of next session if you've, in some sense, got the beginnings of course knowledge sufficient to sketch out what you'd like to write about. Of course, an essay plan doesn't require you to have memorised dates and be able to justify each bullet point with a paragraph, but it does mean you have to have thought about structure of the course, thought about your selection from it, and so on. Should have mentioned this a bit earlier. Sorry, this is a slide from last year. Let me see how much of that's relevant to the critiquing exercise. It's certainly true that when you produce a critique, it's not so much about being right as... Well, it's not so much about the wikis have to be right, as they have to be interesting and helpful. After all, you're unlikely to be, and you shouldn't be using the wikis as a single authoritative source of truth. It's much more about whether they help you get your bearings very quickly in the area, decide whether or not it's what you want to specialise on, and so on. It's fine for critiques to be brief if they're useful to the people receiving it. And I think that's as much as we need now. Right. So for the next segment of this session, I'm going to give a version on public health and well-being. This derives from a lecture Phil Hanlon gave this class 2 or 3 years ago. Phil Hanlon's a professor of public health in this university, and his overall interest is about what controls public health, but in the last 10 years or so, he's got more and more interested in whether the next increment in public health, if there's going to be one, probably has to stop thinking in the old-fashioned way that it's about poverty, it's about specific diseases and so on, and to think much more seriously about whether some cultures are healthier than others, for reasons not unconnected with positive psychology, and above all, other aspects of well-being than just have you got all your limbs and is the water supply clean. So, life expectancy. All right. These slides are already up on the main course page. The first thing to be warned about is if you read the small print along the bottom axis, this is not, time is not linear. It's selected when usable reports came out. So there's a 50-year gap between the first 2 points, a 10-year gap to the next point, 40 years there, and 80 years there. So it's not linear. The first point most of this audience will be happy with, but which I resent bitterly, is why women are allowed to live so much longer than men. Just not working hard enough, that's my interpretation. Actually, I do think that out of a busy and chauvinistic way, but there's a recent bit of data, apparently, out of archaeology, suggesting that women had shorter life expectancies back in the Iron Age or before. And that may well be because women had to work harder there, and they're just being cushioned nowadays. Pack up work early. Anyway, the most important thing to recognise is that, and actually I'd love to be able to see earlier dates, but basically the early half of the Industrial Revolution clearly brought terrible death rates. So famous passing statistic is that late 18th century in London, the birth rate was not replacing the people who were there. It was only immigration from the countryside into London that allowed it to even keep its population, much less expand. That may, of course, be replicated elsewhere. That is, in other cities in their expansionist phase. Then the Victorian philanthropists and so on began to get a grip, and it's been going up. So apparently the public health way of looking at this is to think of it in waves. So the first wave was classic health interventions, particularly water and sanitation. And in fact, if you think good can be measured in the number of human lives saved, probably clean water and effective sewage removal has saved and is saving more lives than the entire medical system. If you executed all the doctors and all the nurses, threw away the pharmaceutical industry, that would damage our health, but not as much as if you threw away these things. And that's why you see on the news, when there's a calamity somewhere in the world, they're often mentioned, even in a tiny BBC summaries, that the first thing is they're worried about cholera and desperate to install a clean water supply. second wave was the first time one could sensibly say science was contributing. We have lots of scientific ideas about why clean water supply is important. I think it's very interesting, though, when you hear scientists being full of themselves, to realise that the big change in London, and I imagine it's similar in other big cities at the time, which was installing a giant sewage system, because London stank so badly the Members of Parliament couldn't bear sitting in the chamber any longer, that was actually carried out under an entirely false theory. They thought that the smell was essentially equivalent to the disease-causing organism, and that was how you died. They hadn't understood that it was the water supply that mattered, and installing a good sewage system only had a big effect because people are drinking water out of wells. It was dramatically less polluted after the sewage system went in. But they didn't understand what they were doing, and still they made a huge difference. In the second wave, you get some science going. Getting science filtering through to being useful. Third wave, they talk about the welfare state. So an interesting and perhaps embarrassing fact about British history is that health improved during the Second World War, even among all that food rationing, exactly because the poor got better nutrition enforced by rationing. Second World War in Britain marked the disappearance of vitamin deficiency diseases, basically. Having a minor resurgence now, but I wouldn't say it's with epidemic proportions. And actually, I know students have higher cultural values than I do and therefore seldom watch the telly, but there's currently a series on the First World War going on, and what it hasn't yet mentioned is what I keep thinking about the First World War, which is that several thousand children essentially starved to death in the First World War, and that was because they didn't get rationing installed until about halfway through. And when food gets short, because Britain imported even more food then than before, if you don't get food through and you believe in the free market, like those idiots did, then the poor can't afford food anymore and you start getting mass deaths. So they fixed it rather late, halfway through the First World War, but when the Second World War happened, the whole civil service knew what had to be done even before war was declared and did something very effective about it. Fourth wave is about lots of healthcare interventions, less to do with basic deprivation and more to do with extending the life of those like me who are basically past their sell-by date for productivity. So one way of looking at cancer, which is dramatically, people's survival is gone up a lot in the last 50 years and is still going up. One interesting angle on cancer, though, is that, according to one book I read, if you do an autopsy on someone who's really survived a long time, let's say 87 and over, the vast majority of people over 87, when you cut them up, turn out to have a number of things wrong with them, most of which haven't yet reached clinical levels. So basically, after 85 or some time, you're almost certain to have a cancer growing in you. The difference this kind of intervention's made is it reduces death in the young, pushes cancer further along our life trajectory. Still, Phil Hanlon, what he wants to know is what could cause a fifth wave? Where's the next increase, if there is going to be one, what's the nature of it? So the things that are epidemic, look like candidates, things like obesity, diabetes, alcohol-related deaths, and we actually don't understand enough about that to have a clear path ahead. Of course, there's some prophets who believe they do know the truth, but it's not clear which prophet is going to turn out to be right. Any of you catch the Horizon program in the last week on sugar? You did? Right.
Sugar and fat.
Yeah, right. So, the bulk of the program was about, is it sugar like some American doctors are saying is the thing that's killing us all, or is it, to take a more old-fashioned view, fat? But the punchline at the end was the thing that actually, although you can damage people if you really put them on a totally sugary diet or a totally fat diet, you damage them a bit. But the real thing, but it actually the effect on the population isn't that big, not nearly as big as the fanatics think expected. What does stand out, though, is a combination of 50% fat and 50% sugar seems to completely get through our normal appetite regulation. So, not many of you will take half a cup of corn oil and put half a spoon of sugar in, but if you start thinking about these foods that we can't stop eating, then ice cream, of course, is a top. Horizon didn't want to lose its audience by saying that ice cream was the product of the devil, but there are quite a few things like that. Actually, one frightening thing which I can't understand is, if any of you familiar with, what's it called? Something like Orange Delight. Looks like fruit juice. My dad, when he was old and demented, started getting it. If you look at the contents, it's absolutely shocking. Oranges have no fat in them, and they put in large amounts of vegetable oil into it. So, sorry?
To make it taste better.
Yes, well. Anyway, so I mention that just because it's likely that the answer isn't going to be straightforward. So Phil Hanlon's own research angle on this, I think, is to do a lot of comparative work between countries, between areas in one country, and see whether the inequalities give us a clue. What is it that's different? Well, what's different between the highest concentrations of early deaths in Scotland and the lowest concentrations? Is it money, which is the familiar left-wing assumption? Is it something else? And for a long time, it looked good to say that poverty was a very strong predictor. But that's beginning to lose its explanatory power in the statistical studies, apparently. Particularly distressing for Glasgow is you can find places in Finland, you can find a city which matches Glasgow a lot, big industrial past, sudden collapse, heritage of deprivation, only partially compensated for. But the comparable place in Finland used to have early deaths as much as Glasgow and is now pulling away. So it looks as if the familiar old explanations are not holding up as well as they should. Yeah. So constituency, they mean political constituency, regions as defined by voting boundaries. And you can see that even after you've allowed for the false negative on the scale, which is all of those who've read that compulsory textbook, How to Lie with Statistics, knows is the very first deception you should pull on audiences. Even after you've allowed for that, you've got to realise that 54 and 86% are a long way apart, and those are big differences. On the other hand, and this is positive psychology, there really isn't a correlation these days between personal income and the percentage of people with that income who report themselves as very happy. Whereas if there are a lot of starving people around, you'd expect that to be a strong correlation, but it's lost its grip, basically. Certainly are differences. Between countries. But focusing on Glasgow again, if any of you who here grew up essentially in Glasgow? At least some of you, okay. Have you, Carol Craig's a sociologist by training, And one of her more recent books is The Tears That Made the Clyde, and it's really about analysing the culture then, the inheritance of that culture now in Glasgow, and suggesting really that it's a poisonous culture that kills people disproportionately, would be the grim way of putting it. And that's why Phil Hanlon and her spend a lot of time thinking about each other's ideas. So if you wanted to follow up Glasgow specifically, you might want to look at that. I'll check in a day or two whether I've got everything I'm hoping for on the already available from my webpage to do with this course, but I think you I've got a pointer there to one or two websites to do with Phil Hanlon's work, and since they're changing, since these slides were made, you might want to follow that up. So here he is, suggesting it's the culture that is perhaps to blame for differential survival rates in Glasgow versus elsewhere. Yes. Oh dear. So one suggestion it's about consumerism in general is driving people to overwork and not enjoy their life. Far be it, and raising the question of whether people trying to measure or at least act on their towards their own happiness are confounding money and happiness in a way that's less and less effective. Mind you, you see, you could still have just the same ambitions for different reasons, though. So I think a lot of people would like to feel that their job benefits people, and I think that's one powerful motivation for people to want to become doctors, is to have a life with grateful patients. And I think for many doctors then and probably now, that's a powerful experience. Of course. Still more powerful if you go out and do voluntary service overseas, where a doctor intervention is likely to be life-changing for a large proportion of patients, and the reality for GPs in Glasgow is they're probably not going to be very effective at helping the people who come through the door, because the people who come through the door are probably basically, if you want to be hostile, you say whingers. If you want to be more objective, you'll say dealing with various kinds of clinical depression, whose causes are actually in their life situation and not for lack of a pill. I was very shocked when I first came to Glasgow. I signed up with a GP recommended by my neighbours and worked in Partick, only a mile away from where I live. Seemed good to me, and I certainly thought well of her. And I was quite shocked when, after a few years, she left the practice. I asked her where she was going. She said, I'm going to be a police doctor. I couldn't understand that someone who'd clearly chosen a relatively deprived area to be a doctor in had finally had enough. And I said, why on earth do you want to be a police doctor? Because you don't have to talk to the patients. And when they cut up rough, other people take care of that. I think you can get quite ground down trying to do the right thing, but nevertheless. Yes. Mind you, looking at this cartoon, it's true that I've evolved into that, but it's hard to believe that that'll kill me as fast as having to practice warfare regularly would. So, as you can see, these slides are moving towards the question about whether a country's well-being should be measured by GDP, that is, annual money turnover, or is it time when governments and individuals need to be focusing on some measure of happiness or well-being that isn't captured by money figures? The slides following this all use this triad of things. This is really Plato's idea. Three components to life: the true, the good, and the beautiful. Oh dear. We all make our specializations. Oh dear, right. But for public health people, the question then is, should there be some integration for public health? I'm not up on it. Has anyone read stuff on whether humans need green spaces? I mean, you can certainly find a polemic asserting that. Has anyone come across any evidence? I mean, I think there is some, but I'm not familiar with it. That is certainly would be the kind of thing Phil would be interested in. And I have to say, though this is just the most rampant speculation, I noticed, for instance, that when I came to Glasgow and felt, you know, there's loads of tall stone tenement buildings, and I thought this is going to be a grim city if I don't have green outside my windows. So I found a tenement overlooking a green square. Even better, you see, someone else maintains it. But I think one of the things that really shook me indirectly was coming across some documentary that was really about technology, and it was about the development and use of AstroTurf and American football. But the story behind it showed that biologists had completely missed something up to then that was important. Because, of course, if you're building a big stadium, money isn't the primary constraint. And one of the reasons many teams went over to plastic imitation grass was because even if it's open to the air, and has got, you know, highly paid gardeners trying to maintain it, it turns out that grass in the bottom of a stadium like that with no natural breeze over it barely lasts 6 weeks. And now they're thinking that grass, and indeed trees as well, are actually listening to airborne, effectively, hormones that tell them something about the life of plants around them. And they've discovered stuff in trees and other grasses that apparently essentially tell each other what they've been attacked by. So when the edge of a forest gets attacked by an insect, it releases stuff that tells all the other trees to start winding up their anti-insect poisons. On the other hand, if it's attacked in some other way, they'll start winding up a different defense system. Well, if even plants are talking to each other in that way, in a way that humans completely overlooked, it does make me wonder whether green spaces might be affecting us and we just haven't been so stupid we haven't looked for the way in which they're doing that. So if you visit Phil Hanlon's website, you'll get expansions on many of these thoughts. And on the interaction of things we might have conventionally felt were independent sorry, actually I'll say a word or two more about the top left. Not sure what Phil was referring to, but I know independently that there's certainly been some increasing awareness in medicine in the last several decades. So, as you may or may not know, or maybe it's recently been closed down, but for a long time, there was an NHS-funded hospital along Great Western Road. Now the keyword's lost. What's the crank branch which deals with ultra-diluted essences? Homeopathy, right. Homeopathic hospital there. Now, what's interesting about that is that the chemists are absolutely clear homeopathy can't be working as they do, because if you do the calculations, the dilutions are so extreme that there cannot be even a single molecule left, because after all, we know how many molecules fit in the 1cc of fluid. It's a gigantic number, but if you dilute it enough, it will be gone. So an old style scientific approach is utterly certain that can't be effective. That's not, however, what studies of the patients seem to always say. And then when you look at it, you see there's a big difference. I don't know if this is still the case, but it used to be that the standard length of a doctor's appointment in Glasgow was 5 minutes, and the standard length at the homeopathic hospital was 50 minutes. And you don't have to have a terribly strong belief in psychological interactions to realise a patient is going to feel a lot more cared for if someone is actually listening to them for 50 minutes as opposed to 5 minutes. And that's a different kind of angle on delivery of services and how it affects patients than a chemistry-driven attitude to medicine is. And another thing, also in Glasgow, maybe out of date, is I met a Mary Hepburn, forgetting the posh name for the medical specialisation, but basically she dealt with maternity, perinatal issues. And the thing she did different that was original was to take the clinics out to the housing estates rather than requiring patients to visit hospitals. And this is more extreme in Glasgow because of the way, unlike other cities, many other cities, the poor got exported out of the centre to the periphery. But being poor, their housing estates typically didn't have very good transport and no other local services, which meant that it was a real penalty for a pregnant woman to make it into the appointments. It would be a financial cost and a huge time cost. Now, one of the things that interested me is that because of how it showed me how most of the health service has always been and still largely is, it's driven by patient fear. So because patients want attention, then if they've got any resources, they'll spend it on getting attention, regardless of whether that's actually important to their health. And because of that, doctors can afford to concentrate their resources in a single place and get angry with patients who don't turn up to appointments. And of course it's a different perspective to reconsider that attitude and think about where the services might have to be delivered if you want to reach a particular group. And the reason Mary Hepburn did start these out clinics there is because Glasgow had an embarrassingly high infant mortality rate that, you know, something like the worst in the country. So, again, it was one of those sort of Glasgow-specific problems that then drew attention. So as I say, if you want to get a sense of that line of reasoning, you can either look for student wikis coming out of this class or go direct to websites associated with Phil Hanlon from pointers on the course webpage. Right. Now, could you please all stand up? You may groan, but you may not stay seated. Right, thank you. Now, sit down if you've never done mindfulness training or mindfulness meditation of any kind ever. About a quarter of the class. Right. So, among these victims, let's begin with you. Tell us a little about your own contact with this, whether you recommend it, why you gave it up, and all the rest of it.
For our middle page, I'm an educational benefit for mindfulness. So, I was looking for practical exercises, and I downloaded an app for your phone which takes you through mindfulness for 10 minutes a day. So, I'm on day 3.
Okay, you can sit down. What's your own contact with it?
I took a class on sports psychology, so we were learning about like breathing exercises, focusing.
Do you maintain this or is that gone? Okay, and why is it gone? Not enough benefit for you?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Worked in as
well, it relieves my stress and whatever.
Oh, really? So, do you keep it up?
Not really, but if I'm really stressed, maybe.
Emergency procedure only. Right, thank you. Man, right at the back.
Yeah, I had one lecture at my university back home in New York, and we had to do breathing exercises and. I don't know what's it called, but if you are afraid of something, it's just language that makes you afraid of the thing. So you have to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, so you'd get used to it.
Does that work on you?
Not really. No, it's more the mindfulness aspect of the whole thing that really did caught my interest.
And do you maintain a regular
meditation? Yeah. Yeah, if I feel like it.
And so what would you say the chief benefit for you is that keeps you...
The chief benefit of practical exercises and mindfulness training is that you you actually take time for yourself to organize your thoughts and your feelings and just leave everything the way it is. Just take a step back from everything.
Right. Right. Thank you very much. You?
Done it at the end of a yoga class. No, then it's just breathing.
So do you maintain it, or is that...
No, not at all.
Okay, thank you.
I get told to do it.
And?
Yeah, no, it's good. But I've been trying to do it every day, so, yeah.
So you're keeping it up, and you think it's worthwhile, at least so far?
I'll wait and see.
Do you feel any benefits now?
Yeah, no, it helps with intrusive thoughts and things like that.
Sorry, what about thoughts? It helps?
It helps with intrusive thoughts.
Intrusive thoughts, right. Shuts them up a bit. Okay, thank you. So sit down.
I've been doing Buddhist meditations for the past 2 years. I try doing it every day, but sometimes it's difficult because we've got lots to do and stuff. But,
but actually, you're a long-term believer.
Yeah. I think it really helps because if you take even a few minutes or at least half an hour every day, then it makes you sort of as you said, take a step back from everything that you think is too important, because if you calm yourself down and you have a time to look at it objectively, you realize a lot of it doesn't really matter that much as you normally would think. But it's really hard to keep that up in every day, because obviously we're so used to taking things seriously that don't necessarily need to be taken seriously. It's like the idea is to eventually get there.
Thank you very much.
I tried Buddhist meditation as well, and then I had it was basically just dropping classes at another school for during exam times, especially for meditation, but then tried to keep it up.
So you do keep it up?
Especially when, like, if there's more stress, but yeah, I try to keep it up every day. It's just a little, like, literally a couple of minutes. Just empty your head before you go to bed.
And the way you think of its benefit is about stress reduction. Is that right?
For sure, yeah. And then just realizing, like, you know, you get these ideas when you do it, or things suddenly fall into place. About.
Thank you.
I had problems sleeping, and my friend who took a class on mindfulness back in my home uni, she recommended some of the exercises, such as body scans, and yeah, I did that.
And did it help?
Yeah.
So for you, it's insomnia.
Yes.
That it helps with. Thank you very much.
I've been to that Sami Lang Buddhist Centre, and as part of that, they encouraged us, when we were taught, it was like a school pit thing, and they encouraged everyone to try it out and meditate a little bit. But I think it's a really good benefit for me personally.
Right. Also, thank you very much.
I would recommend a book by John Kabat-Zinn a couple of years ago, just because, again, I kind of just have a very overactive mind, have a lot going on in there, so like I kind of do it just because it helps me to realise when I'm getting wound up about something and like just sort of go through it and not like, yeah, just try to be a bit more self-aware about when it's happening so it doesn't get hungry.
So you're a long-term believer, really?
Yeah, like at the minute I'm doing it like every day, but like when I get busy I sometimes fall behind a little bit in that as well, but I try to keep on going.
Thank you very much.
I started doing it and I kept it up for about 3 months maybe. I didn't really find the benefits, and I kind of attributed that to, I felt like I was quite mindful anyway, and so and upping my mindfulness wasn't really helping. But thinking of the basic principles when you're really stressed does help, like just the being in the moment thing and not being thinking about worrying about the future. That does help.
Thank you. Anyone else have anything to say?
I remember my dad told me about a year ago they started introducing a lot of Catholic primary schools across South Lanarkshire Christian meditation. And this is purely anecdotal evidence, but I was told by a couple of different head teachers who had influence in their schools, they saw behaviour levels improving, which I thought was very interesting.
You're so polite. You were really saying it's just for sickies and that healthy people like you didn't need it.
No.
And they were saying it's to deal with disciplinary problems. Any other comments? No? Right, thank you. Let's take a 5-minute break or so, and then I'll have some more remarks about mindfulness. Sorry, I should have clipped that out. So this is basically a graph of the literature. So as you can see, somewhere around 2001 or something, academic references on mindfulness training started to take off. This slide, which I stole from someone else, is suggesting there's two angles on this, the scientific on the left, a poetic on the right. Of course, it's both, like it's both experiential and we can try and sometimes succeed at measuring more objective behavioural outcomes. There are different flavours which I'm not going to explore about exactly the kind of training. So up there he's talking about training aimed at stress reduction and a somewhat different training aimed at cognitive therapy. But how does it work? And we heard some of these themes from members of the audience. reduction in negative thoughts and emotions, enhancement of positive emotions, improvement in self-control. So, of course, they may all be true. Now, I'm going to divert for a few slides to other meanings, and that's partly because I think one of the things that's interesting to do if you get keen on positive psychology is to think about connections which haven't necessarily been discussed in the literature but might be interesting. Because after all, as you probably have gathered, in psychology, as in most, and in probably most sciences, there's opposing tendencies in the long run. One tendency is to narrow things down to a specific definition, a particular experimental setup, because that's what you need to get reproducible results. And the opposite tendency is to reach outwards and look for cross connections, and so on. This is going to be a hand-waving cross-connection suggestion. So, last week, I went to a talk in Glasgow, but by Yvonne Rogers, who works down south. And she was using the word mindful in her talk for different purposes. And so, for me, that was quite interesting to think about what the different meanings might be. And I'm going to, it's not that Yvonne directly said that, it was that in trying to process her talk and write up my notes on it afterwards, this is the current state of my bullet points, as it were, about different senses of mindful. And I think they're all interesting, and they're certainly interesting if you wanted to be critical. So, first one about attention. Quite a fundamental problem for humans, actually for all animals, is how to direct one's attention. And the fundamental reason for that is that we want and need to achieve multiple things, but often you can only do one thing at a time. And that's true in a very fundamental way. If you're using your legs to walk, you can't use them typically to kick someone. Any bodily organ, not just our brain, can, generally speaking, just be used for one thing at a time, and then the question is, what should it be? So this isn't really about being human. So, for instance, a lot of herbivores, a lot of large herbivores like deer, because evolution doesn't work as well as the naive imagine, have got a really fundamental problem. They've got this big head, it's got almost all their sensory organs on, but it's also got their mouth. So the choice for a horse or a cow or a wildebeest, most of these things, is, am I going to have my head down and eat, or am I going to have my head up and be safe? And it's a particularly acute for herbivores, because a lot of them, particularly the larger ones, eat very low-grade food. That means they have to spend a huge proportion of their waking life eating, or they'll gradually get malnourished. So that means it's no good them saying safety first, because safety first means you die immediately of starvation. So the question's about the trade-off. How do you manage things? How do you manage where your attention is? Now, we all have developed quite a lot of skills so that we don't all the time feel that that's a problem. But when you start to think about the things you've managed to coordinate, it's quite surprising, really. You know, you can run and breathe at the same time. Have to coordinate it a bit. You can get on with your bit of studying, but nevertheless react immediately the phone rings. You can, as a young suburban couple, actually have people around to dinner, attend to an adult conversation, but nevertheless, not only if a child yells, but even more tellingly, if there's suddenly an unexpected silence from upstairs, you see the parents go and you realise that, probably without them being exactly conscious of it, we say loosely multiprocessing. Well, that's true and it isn't true. It is true that they're managing to cope with two tasks at the same time, even though not in the same millisecond. And then that's why I got monitoring in brackets, because a lot of our ways of coping are about knowing we'll be alerted so we don't have to have our top attention there. And it's not only phone bells. There's a lot we use our sensory organs quite a lot. So, for instance, if I'm making breakfast, and you can observe this in a lot of other people, if they're in their familiar kitchen, it's when the kettle stops making a noise, you know it's ready. And that's kind of interesting, because we're more used to thinking a loud noise gets everyone's attention. But when you're in a familiar environment, the cessation of a noise is actually enough to alert. But a stranger in that kitchen wouldn't know that that was the cue, and so on. So we have a lot of strategies around that. It's a general issue. One meaning of the word mindful, then, is really to do with attention. It's about managing attention. What are you concentrating on? What are you got? Alerting mechanisms there, so you're not concentrating on it, but you'll nevertheless, it won't get past you. And what are you actually oblivious of? I haven't got these in. I haven't got some Gossan Waller here. If you remember what I was saying about flow earlier, one of the interesting things there is that for someone in flow, the activity is absolutely flowing through their senses. It's processed very quickly by the conscious mind. How do we know this? Well, because if you interrupt them at a point, they can tell you what they're doing. But if you ask them about it even a few minutes later, and certainly the next day, they won't remember. So there's an interesting question about the extent to which that counts as consciousness when you're in flow. So it's not quite the same thing to say that what you're ever conscious of is somehow stays in the mind. A lot of it instantly, well, almost immediately leaves. But a rather different sense of mindfulness, but one which was mentioned by a number of those giving testimonials this afternoon about mindfulness training, is reflection in some sense, that is, thinking over things that have happened. And I'm going to talk more about that in a moment, but in Yvonne's talk, though maybe not necessarily for purposes here, is her talk included the difference it makes when you're able to see something you're not normally able to do, because one of the projects Yvonne was describing in this talk was about a project with special research user interfaces about could you help make people in their domestic setting more aware of their electricity consumption, more likely to reduce it. And one of the issues there is that we at most see a bill every month or every 3 months, and that is not a measure that's very much use for managing our electricity consumption. We kind of want to need to know it day by day, maybe even hour by hour. We'd like separate meters on every appliance, so, because most people have no engineering understanding of which appliances are taking most of the power. If you provide people with these more data, it's like growing a new sense, and that brings into your mind the information that allows you to reflect in a useful way. In other words, become mindful of, in this case, electricity consumption, in a way that can and is quite likely to lead to action. And that's it's a different sense, but it's very relevant to what we're able to reflect on, which is obviously limited by what we're ever aware of. Now, in one sense, this slide is all about possible different words used for one thing, about thinking about your life, contemplation, if you like, which is, according to some of the testimonials this afternoon, definitely one aspect of mindfulness meditation. And I think what's interesting is what a different cultural load different to these words carry. So over Christmas I saw a documentary by Sister Wendy Beckett. She's a nun. She's relatively well known in the UK for having made a number of art history programs about paintings, but she describes herself as a hermit. I think that's a technical ecclesiastical sense, because it certainly isn't about never talking to people. It's just that her daily life, she isn't even in company with the other nuns. And she says she spends about 6 hours a day in prayer. Now, when a child or a not very sincere person talks about prayer, it's usually associated with the kind of cynical remark that came out of the First World War, to the effect that there are no atheists in foxholes when they're being shelled. In other words, when we're in desperate need, we plead to have someone fix our personal situation, regardless of the interests of anyone else. This clearly isn't what Wendy Beckett is talking about. This isn't prayer to get the next consumer item or even to have her life saved. This is contemplation. This is spending... The major activity in her life seems to be, in some sense, thinking things over. So there's a famous quote from English translations of Plato's Apology about an unexamined life is not worth living. That's suggesting a value that you're not living much of a life if you don't do any of this. I think reflection would be the vocabulary word that seems most natural to me. But the point of this slide really is to connect things which I would never before have thought may be the same thing underneath. It's about processing stuff that's already present to you in some way. And note how different, going back to the previous slide, note how different that is from flow, which is about continuous action. Reflection is almost a counterpart part in some sense. On the other hand, this kind of reflection is clearly relevant to positive psychology if it's true, as a number of you seem to have experienced, and certainly I would go along with, that we're not going to be very happy if we have uncontemplated business hanging about and don't ever make time for taking a view on it. And part of that is really Seligman's point about learned optimism, which one or two people said is that when they get anxious, then they do more mindfulness meditation. And one of the effects of that is to a lot of things that seemed difficult and anxiety-provoking actually, on examination, seem a lot less bothering. Right. And the last segment I want to do is to sketch this new topic of possible educational benefits of mindfulness. So I only became aware of this because Siobhan Lynch gave a talk at a conference in Glasgow in the summer and caught my attention. So, how do we get into this? Well, as mentioned earlier, mindfulness training's become strongly established in the academic literature in the last 20 years. Many studies show benefits in clinical populations, others show benefits in subclinical populations. And there's a review paper out. I'll try and get these references up on my page in the next day or two. This review paper shows that there's a collection of studies that show that mindfulness training reduces anxiety levels in specifically student populations. And there'd be no surprise, though I haven't seen a direct study reporting this, no surprise that if you reduce student anxiety, probably their learning performance will go up. So I don't think any of us would be surprised, on the basis of the rest of the mindfulness literature, if there was a benefit to students, as there is to many other kinds of people, from mindfulness training in reducing anxiety, and that would knock on. What was a new idea to me is that there's some recent evidence that suggests there may be rather more direct effects on students' learning performance from mindfulness training, not just about reducing anxiety, useful though that would be. In particular, there's this paper, and again I'll try and get the reference up in the next day or two, that showed an increase in North American exam on scores of reading comprehension. And if I'm reading their results right, I haven't read this very carefully, and they don't say this directly, but if I'm reading the tables right, it's something like a 20% increase in marks on this section of that exam in the experimental group who got the pre to post rise in scores was something like 20%. And furthermore, the bit that they're emphasising in that paper is that's mediated in statistical jargon. That is, the detailed results analysis suggests that the mindfulness training reduces mind wandering, and that is what then has an effect on raising scores in the test. Or to put it rudely, it's a kind of anti-ADHD treatment. A bit like at least one person was talking about. And
I was wondering, do you know, did they do mindfulness sort of while they were studying for the exam, like throughout the time, or like before taking the exam?
I think you need to read the paper, or to put it another way, you've caught me out, you bastard. I think they think it helps during the exam. Sorry, yes. But I don't know whether they actually do the exercises during the exam or whether...
Yeah.
No, we'd have to read the details, and obviously we'd have to replicate it because training varies in various ways and you never know when a variation matters and when it doesn't. Still, referring back to the earlier list, that suggests in this case that the benefit is about controlling attention and not getting distracted when you're trying to focus. So if that stands up and more results come in propping that up further, then any applied educationalist like me thinks that must mean we should be rolling it out for all students, shouldn't we? Or if you're a private enterprise type, that means forcing students to take out extra loans to pay for this tremendous copyrighted training. Either way, the rollout would be beginning to think about this as something all students should do. Now, I hear, but don't know directly, that this is already going on in the school sector, as Luke alluded to. And one symptom of that is that a couple of years ago, in this lecture, I had someone called Michael Breedy, who's a local trainer and practitioner in mindfulness training, and when I looked him up to see whether it would be worth asking whether he could do it again this year, his old website disappeared and a new one had appeared, and it's clear he's now got a whole bunch of money landing on him dealing with training in school, mindfulness training in schools. So this is already big business in a companion educational sector. For me, personally, the question is, should I be thinking about organising that in this university? So Siobhan has done a PhD on this and is impressed with results in the field generally as well as hers, wants to see it rolling out in higher education. And so one question is, could this be done online, which would make it cheaper and more rapid? More rapid in the rollout, cheaper to fund whoever's paying for it. And there's one paper reporting success in one particular case of online training. Sarah and I are rather keen to collaborate with Siobhan in seeing about whether we could get this started in this university, and probably with some sort of hybrid pedagogical model, such as having an online course as one component, having Siobhan as a long-distance advisor as another component, having local groups who meet face-to-face in a traditional way, and they're perhaps led by a student who's been through the training before and had a bit of extra training as a facilitator. Pyramid model, partly supported online, partly with local study group type structure. There's another paper Siobhan pointed me to, which I haven't absorbed even briefly yet, but which I think it, well, actually, it may have been Reed's, but it showed that it studied what learners, people who are learners in mindfulness training, thought of online versus face-to-face, and basically it looks as if some students favour one and some the other, and people have quite strong preferences, but they're not all in one direction. So that's the exciting new current direction. Any questions on that? How many of you, if you're not of the three quarters of the class who aren't already doing it, feel this is something you'd sign up to if this was a year or two ago? I mean, that is if you were not in the last few months of your undergraduate career, but a year or two earlier. Might be some appetite, yes. Okay, so I think that's the last of the new content for this session, and I'll just, if there are no questions about that, I'll just end with a reminder about what I hope you'll do for next week. So most of you have got to draft your wiki up, the rest should do it as soon as possible. What I want all of you to do is to generate your allocated critique. You can do more than one if you like, but at least one would ensure that every group gets three or four critiques back. You should be receiving critiques by the next session, let's hope, and that will give you a week before the coursework deadline in which to change anything you wish in your own wiki if there's something about the critiques that stimulates further ideas in you. And as I said before, I'll be spending a considerable proportion of next week's session in practice essay plans for exam questions. Get you tuned in, allow you to grumble before it's too late, and all of that stuff. Okie dokie.
But I got her at a bad time because she was going off to lecture or meeting in 10 minutes. Told her that I would send